to the first Get in the Sea podcast, where a guest and myself pour hot scorn and ire over some of the more moronic things we've seen over the last couple of weeks and consign them to the depths of the Mariana Trench forever. My name is Theo Priestley, and I'm a futurist, author, and associate fellow with the Tony Blair Institute for Global Change. And with me today is the most interesting person in the room who has logged off.
I'm right here.
Oh, you're right here.
I'm right here. I haven't gone anywhere.
Okay, for anyone who's just joining, we've had Friday the 13th problems with technology, and I'll tell you what, technology can get in the fucking sea as far as I'm concerned today. So, Bronwyn is a futurist, economist, and trend analyst, and also the most interesting person in this room today. Part human, part econ, her work looks at the complexity of pretty much everything and what that means for you, for your business, for your nation, and for your world. She works as a business trends analyst and foresight lead at Flux Trends, which is South Africa's leading trends insight company. Bronwyn, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. Now that we've got technology on our side.
A question that I get asked a lot, which is, what the fuck is a futurist? I wonder if you could give me your version of what that answer could be.
Yeah. Well, number one, being a futurist is not about predicting the future. It's about changing the future. So basically, if you and I do our jobs right, the future is not going to be what it was yesterday.
You gave a TED talk, which I found really interesting, which was, do you want to live forever? Do you want to maybe give us a brief synopsis of that and whether we should actually be thinking about living forever or just living till we're 100 and just enjoy the life that we have?
Well, that was the question I asked. So the TED Talk was really about exploring what is possible, because, you know, that whole thing of transhumanism has gone on for a while now. It's now a bit of a buzzword in the future space. Maybe not everyone's familiar with it yet, but the whole concept of using technology and biology and all those tools we have available to us to extend our lifespans as far as possible and to increase our health as far as possible, which sounds on the surface like quite a noble goal, right? You know, like, who doesn't want to live forever and be healthy and happy forever? But there's obviously a catch, and I think that that's a lot of the things that we talk about as futurists, is that there's always a catch. There's always another side to the sword. And when it comes to living forever, you know, I don't know if you've met too many old people these days, how many of them are excited about, you know, living for another 20, 30 years. Eventually, I don't know, maybe we get tired of playing this game on planet Earth, on our third rock from the sun. So I think that we get, maybe there's a bit of a sort of marginal returns to longevity that we might not have fully considered. And that's just on the sort of human side of things. And then, of course, the other side is the economic side. If you're going to live forever, that means you've got to work forever, right? I mean, a pension fund's supposed to last you for through your last sort of 20 years of old age. But if you sort of, you know, going to live forever, does that mean you have to keep on working and earning money forever? Like, when is it okay to step into the social welfare net? I don't know. Those are the sort of complicated questions. So I would suggest that maybe living forever is for some people, but not for everyone. And the other thing, of course, is if we all live forever, where are we all going to fit? Because, you know, people keep on making new babies. So then do you say, oh, do you have to, if old people get to live forever, does that mean that new babies should not be allowed to be born at all? You know, who gets preference? Does the past human get preference, or does the future generation get preference? And that's probably one of those big debates that we're going to see more and more of. And honestly, if you're alive today, you know what I'm talking about. We all know about the millennials versus boomers. And if you think that divide is wide, just wait until you see what the alphas are going to think about us and our modern monetary theory policies, guys. We've got it coming.
I'm just so glad I'm Gen X, because we just seem to be getting on with it and letting the other lot battle it out between themselves. Yes. And I've also seen In Time, which isn't a bad film, with Justin Timberlake. And as usual, the rich get to swan around and have parties, and the rest of us have to prop up their society and let them live forever. To crack on in this first Get in the Sea podcast, we've actually selected quite a nice range of things which we've chosen as extremely horrible examples of where society is right now. I'm going to kick off with the first one, which is the world's first smart candle, believe it or not. Yes, people, we have entered peak Internet of Things here, where you can actually connect candles to the internet and control sparking them up with a smartphone. the first, I don't know whether this says anything about my personality or not, but the first thing I thought about was, wouldn't this be great for arsonists? I immediately thought, well, you could remake the Backdraft film and use this as the main plot device rather than the guy using some kind of synthetic material in plugs. I just can't believe that the best minds in Silicon Valley come up with devices like this for society at the moment. I mean, not everything needs to be connected to the internet. Not everything needs to be smart. But here we are trying to connect wax candles to the internet via Wi-Fi or Bluetooth or whatever, just because we're so lazy that we can't spark up with a lighter. I mean, I don't understand where society is going. I mean, what's your take on this one?
Oh, my favorite part of that candle is that you can't switch it off remotely. So, I mean, you know, there's obviously a few unintended consequences that could happen there. But as you're saying, it's basically like a really low-grade, do-it-yourself, autonomous weapon, right? Oh, it could do anything. But I suppose before we continue, I should probably be honest with your listeners, because I'm completely pro-free market. I'm quite libertarian on that side of things, but I'm also completely pro-free speech, which means that as much as I will defend your right to make or buy a smart candle, if that's really what you want to do with your limited time here on planet Earth, I also am completely behind my own rights to mock you for your choices, both from a practical point of view and from an ethical point of view. So I think we need to reserve the right to judge each other a little bit, but also, you know, by all means, go ahead and build your silly machines, but people like you and I are definitely going to laugh about it.
You selected for your first one something which I find is, you may defend people's rights to come up with some clever ideas like this, but this is really just not a clever idea in any sense. Disposable, well, hankies, basically. Do you want to take this one away?
Yeah. There's a company that's disrupting, as they say, the disposable tissue market by creating a reusable tissue, which I'm sure most people over the age of, I don't know, 12 might recognize as being a good old-fashioned handkerchief. So, you know, if you can add technology to anything, but that doesn't necessarily make it a tech product. I think it just really speaks to the real lack of real innovation that we have today. I mean, we talk about smart candles and smart handkerchiefs, and I mean, that's really nonsense sort of innovations. That's not the sort of things that are going to build civilization or get us to be immortal beings or merge our minds with machines and all of that. This is just sort of playing around in the real shallow end of the VC pool. And I think there's a lot of that going on at the moment, where particularly in like your first world, your rich, weird world, you know, that like Western, industrialized, educated, weird world. It's not the world that we all live in. But that world is really seeming to be playing with a spinnovation instead of real innovation. And that's why you've got thinkers like Peter Thiel saying things like, what's really changed since the 1980s other than the screens that are distracting us from what's going on? I mean, we still ride around in over 100-year-old subways, and we still have, you know, hundreds of year-old waterways. Those are the things that really change our lives. But instead, we're messing around trying to sell each other smart candles and smart handkerchiefs.
Do you think these guys have actually launched at the right time, given the coronavirus? Because we're now all scrabbling around looking for toilet roll, and here's these guys with a reusable handkerchief.
Yeah.
Do you think we'll actually see the equivalent of reusable toilet paper?
Oh wow, that does sound like fun. Maybe not. Let's not go that far. Maybe we should stop focusing on toilet paper and start worrying about our old people. But yeah, I think they seem to be quite lucky, because they brought that out just before the coronavirus news broke. So maybe they are smarter than we're giving them credit for. Maybe they knew something was coming.
Now, your second one, you picked something which was actually really quite interesting, and it's a bit of a it falls under the kind of law of unintended consequences in a way, but on the darker side.
Yeah, absolutely. So this is a lot, this is a subject that I spend quite a lot of time looking at, and this whole sort of intersection between the surveillance state and surveillance capitalism. So both of those sides of other way we're giving away more and more data and being forced to give away more and more of our personal data and more of our personal privacy in exchange for the sort of veneer of security or convenience. So whether you're looking at the state side or the corporate side. But I think the intersection of those two worlds is where it's really scary. So as much as surveillance capitalism is Google and Facebook and all the rest of it tracking you and selling you things you don't need, like smart candles and smart handkerchiefs, the sort of more creepy side is when they're using that data and integrating it into, say, state surveillance systems to actually start you know, monitoring people more and more. So the case that I picked up was a guy who had bought himself one of those smart sort of fitness trackers to ride around and get his points from his insurer, or, you know, just to monitor his health, or biohack himself to try and give him some longevity. If we want to go back to the immortality angle there. And he was riding his bike around, gathering his points and his data. And the next thing he knew, he was being investigated by law enforcement because he had happened to ride past a house that was burgled. So I don't know how you feel about that, but I don't know if I really feel so happy about the devices that I'm buying for me as a consumer actually turning informer against me and ratting on me to my police state that's then going to investigate me as a criminal. Now, in this case, the guy was completely innocent. He was just wrong place at the wrong time. But I think it's quite a wake-up call to figure out that, you know, these sort of innocent devices we buy and give each other as Christmas presents are actually maybe spying on you a little bit for characters you didn't know what was going on. And of course, there's loads of examples there with things like the 23andMe DNA samples, and how if you go send off to find out what your genetic ancestry is, you also end up on FBI databases. I mean, you know, that's in the fine print, that's in the T's and C's. So yeah, maybe we need to look a bit more carefully at what we're doing when we're buying all these shiny new toys.
Yeah, I remember reading about the Alexa case where they were using recordings based on domestic violence and murder. And yeah. And I've also read, you know, the Tesla surveillance mode when you park your car and it records what goes on. And obviously there's a thing called Tesla Envy or whatever it is, where people just vandalize Teslas randomly because they just don't like them. But the interesting thing that I heard about and read about was suggestions around using Tesla as a way to track missing people or kidnapped children, for example, and letting the police authorities tap into live recordings or the recordings on Teslas as they drive around to spot criminal activity. And it did actually make me think that as cars are becoming more sophisticated, with live cameras being fed to the cloud, that they could, in a sense, just become another extension of the police and, you know, medical services and everything else. We will literally be online 24/7 being watched no matter where we go. And it is kind of a scary thought in the sense that there is no escape.
Yeah, that's exactly the thing. So as I like to tell people, especially in the businesses that I work with, it's like for the first time in human history, we actually have, thanks to technology, the ability to implement the most extreme forms of politics available to us. On the one hand, you've got the ability to institute a complete surveillance state, to close that loop, to, you know, complete that ring. That's sort of picking up on that terrible Dave Eggers book, The Circle, which is an awful novel, but it's a very good commentary on what's going on in the world today. So I'd recommend you read it, not for the story, but just for the fact that it really does sum up what's going on there with closing that loop, because a complete surveillance totalitarian state is now a possibility. It was something that, of course, your people like your Stalins and your Hitlers would have loved to have been able to do 100 years ago, but they couldn't because the technology wasn't there. But now we can absolutely see that states or bad acting states can actually do that. On the other hand, there's always another hand or always another side, whether you're a futurist or an economist, there's always another angle to look at. We've also got the ability to basically completely leave the state behind. So anarchy also becomes a real possibility, which wasn't before. And that's thanks to your more sort of decentralized technologies that are coming on board, from your privately issued currencies, like of course all your crypto stuff, to the way that now services that traditionally public goods that had to be provided by a central authority can now be provided by individuals. So even things like electricity production, previously you had to have a central monopoly to do that, otherwise it didn't make sense. Now you can generate your own electricity, you can collect your own water from the air. In fact, you can even make your own alcohol out of the air, thanks to technology they got now. So you've got these two very diverging world views, and it's going to be interesting, as they say, in the sort of sense of that faux Chinese curse, to see which way this is all going to fall. But we live in very precarious times. We could end up falling on either side of the tightrope, and perhaps it's up to us to choose a bit more about which sort of services we want to support. And that comes back to the guy riding his pedometer on his bicycle. Like, maybe he hadn't thought about what the implications were. You think he's just tracking a little bit of your life, but you're just sort of plugging into that whole surveillance loop. And do we really want to be participating in that? Or do we want to be maybe resisting that a little bit or finding the balance? Because there's always that sliding scale between security and privacy. And unfortunately, I think we're probably getting past those marginal returns to security in exchange for what we're giving away in terms of our privacy and our freedoms. So they say that, like, you know, surveillance cameras in streets up until a certain point can reduce crime. But if you zoom out a bit, those stats, you find that crime doesn't reduce. Crime just shifts to locations that don't have as many cameras. So you actually end up making your poorer, more destitute suburbs and places of living more dangerous by surveilling more in your public-facing, shiny, middle-class buildings. So you've got all these interesting sort of ripple effects that come on board from this, but definitely one of those massive conversations that we should all be having a bit more of.
Yeah, that reminds me of Predpol, which was the algorithmic sort of police prediction software. And part of their study with New York Police and I think Kent Police as well in the UK showed that while they predicted hotspots, for example, they reduced the crime there. But like you say, the unintended consequence was that the crime just went somewhere else where they weren't being monitored. And crime rose in other suburbs. So pushing crime elsewhere didn't really solve a problem at all. And going back, continuing this theme, actually, I picked an article which I saw around the Ring product, which is one of Amazon's products, which they bought. It's worth around $1.8 billion now as a market. And you can install Ring in your your home for answering the door because it has a camera, and you can answer it via smartphone, or you can use it as surveillance in home to check on children, say in the nursery, or just basically put it around in rooms in your home to check when you're actually out on holiday to make sure you're not being burgled. The problem here, again, is that when people install these things, they don't update any of the settings, they don't update the admin passwords, they just use the old admin that comes straight out of the box. And of course, hackers are having a whale of a time by hacking into these devices and being rather sinister and dark about it. So in this particular instance, in DeSoto County, a mother basically shared the Ring video with a journalist after the camera was installed. 4 days it took someone to basically just hack in and have a conversation with their 8-year-old daughter. And I just found that creepy as fuck. And it also highlights that people are extremely naive when they buy these items, thinking that it just makes their home secure, when in fact it just opens the door to all sorts.
Yes.
And for me, it also highlights that the duty of care, I guess, in a way, from companies like Amazon, they just don't. They don't care as long as they get the money from the product. But more often than not, people are completely ignorant of technology because they expect it to work. Thanks to Apple, everything needs to, you know, work straight out of the box. And everyone has that kind of mentality now where they buy something, pull it out of the box, plug it in, and it works. And they don't need to do anything. And they have completely forgotten that they actually have to do something, which is secure it even more than they've ever secured before. And again, I don't know what your thoughts on this one are, Bronwyn, but I'm pretty sure that you've already covered it already with the poor guy on his bike. But I just think we've become technologically, I don't know, ignorant or just naive to everything that's going on around us.
Oh, absolutely. I suppose I can take that in a couple of ways. So you're talking about how those devices that we bring into our homes, the sort of surveillance devices that we bring into our homes, we get unintended consequences of people hacking in. But there's also the very defined intended consequences that we sometimes forget about. So my favorite example here is Barbie's Dream House. If you haven't seen the video, go onto YouTube and go look at Barbie's Dream House, the advert. It's very cute. Barbie's got a smarter house than you have. You know, you just do your voice command and the slides, the stairs turn into a slide, or the lights come on, or the disco ball turns on. It's all great. It's basically the vision of the smart home that we were promised in the 80s that we never quite got, right? Because the future never quite lived up to our expectations. And it's a great toy, but the fully intended purpose of this device is actually to start collecting voice-based consumer data from your children in your home, if you read the terms and conditions on this product, which I have done, and I screenshot them and I put them in my presentations when I do keynotes to scare all the parents in the room, it says very clearly that Mattel will collect data from your children and use it to build a consumer profile. So in that case, it's more like the vampire analogy is the best one to use. Consumers have to be aware that when you invite these devices into your homes, they can suck your data and suck your personal info, just like a vampire can in science fiction. You know, we have to stop inviting them in while we still have the choice, because once those sort of loops close and they become normalized in society, you find that your neighbors are making a decision to trade away your privacy on your behalf. So if you look at the ring analogy again, once a certain number of homes in your neighborhood have that device, effectively your whole neighborhood is surveilled, even if you don't have it, because those devices obviously have a radius. And that's really probably where the tipping point comes in. So we need to be very careful, each and every one of us, by not inviting things in that we don't fully understand. We also need to start thinking about those externalities of how we are trading away each other's freedoms and each other's privacy, which I think is also something that's worth talking about. And I suppose the last point I have on that whole thing about surveillance and predictive policing, which you touched on a bit earlier, which I think is worth talking about, is how predictive policing is slightly different to surveillance. So surveillance is tracking based on data, so they know where you are and what you're doing and all the rest of it, whether it's through audio or through visual. But predictive policing is when you start using now algorithms to make inferences by saying, not like the guy on the bike who was literally in front of the house at the time it was being robbed, but rather when you start using data profiles of people who knew the guy, and when you start saying, oh, he happened to be in a restaurant with someone who was there. So say his friend is now inferred because they both have a pedometer, they both have a device that links them to each other. Suddenly a third party, like his girlfriend or his friend, could also be linked to that crime scene, which he wasn't actually guilty. I think we need to make that clear too. And that's when you start making inferences, and that's what predictive policing is. That if you've done any sort of statistics or any sort of economics in the theory, you know that those false negatives and those false positives are where the real problems come in. Because even if your system is very accurate, you end up collecting more innocent people in your dragnets than guilty ones, much like our poor guy on the bike. And that's when things get very, very worrying. I know the UK is doing quite a lot of that in sort of inferring whether you could be involved in a terrorism ring or not, based on the sort of friends you have on your social media platforms and on where you've happened to be. But that's when it gets quite scary, because that's when you've got a state by rule by algorithm and not rule by human sense. And when computers start saying no, and there's garbage coming into the computer system and garbage going out of the computer system, we end up with this kind of scary world where, in black and white, in data, in the system, it says you are likely to be guilty, and you've got to then prove yourself innocent, which is kind of the opposite way to the way our whole rule by law Western civilized society has been set up to work. So we need to be aware of these sort of things, and we really need to be concerned about how much information we're giving away to both states and to corporations. So that's the end of my sermon on that topic.
It's interesting that you talk about inference, because and Facebook, funnily enough, one of the examples that I've seen in the past is that credit scoring systems and lenders are using your Facebook profile and the people that you're connected with to infer whether or not you are worthy of being lent money to. So your social circle is being almost categorized and used against you. And that's really interesting in a sense, because, you know, you could use Facebook for a completely different reason other than connecting with family and friends, but you are being judged on the company you keep, as the saying goes. We're in this situation where you can't backpedal anymore unless you actually delete yourself from these kind of sort of apps and services. So it's, we're in a strange, precarious situation, and I think we're beyond the tipping point in some respects. Your next one, I don't even know how to begin with this one. It seems to me like the porcine race are rising up against the farmers. I don't know how you want to frame this one at all.
Well, I think it follows on very nicely with what you just said. As we're getting to this tipping point, how do we resist it? Well, some farm animals have some ideas of how we can resist it. So, I mean, it's got wonderful analogies going back to Orwell and Animal Farm and all the rest of it, and animals rising up against oppression, right? So there's this great story that came out of Leeds where some farmers, in an effort to prove that their pork is free range, had put tracking devices onto their animals. So Microsoft offers a lot of these sort of connected cow, connected farmyard offers for farmers to track how much food they're eating, where the animal's roaming, how much space it's got, all the rest of it, because obviously consumers are quite into, you know, transparent consumption cycles and more sustainable consumption cycles. That's the motivation why farmers are actually starting to put these tracking pedometer devices onto their animals. And in this particular case, a pig managed to get its pedometer off its foot and then subsequently managed to eat the pedometer. And when it, you know, finished its life cycle, it ended up back in the pig's feed and promptly caught on fire and caused quite a large amount of damage to the farm. So it's quite nice sort of, you know, it's a nice example of how you can resist these sort of systems by, like, literally crapping on them, I suppose. There's no nice way to put that.
Yeah, I've pretty much seen the same thing with cows, and I'm sure I read last week that there is a chicken farmer who's basically using trackers as well to prove how free-range his chickens are. And I thought that we had a more benign solution, that blockchain was supposed to do all of this for us, because blockchain was supposed to, I don't know, cure cancer and save the climate as well. So I'm a bit disappointed that blockchain didn't save this bad guy's 75 acres of farm going up in smoke after the pig crapped on it. While we were expecting technology to help farmers, for example, in vertical farming or land reclamation and make better use for irrigation, we're attaching them to various animals and they're just running riot and causing havoc, which I think is great. So we've only had one mention of the coronavirus so far, right at the beginning of the program, which is disappointing. But I thought I'd bring it right back down to this, because I saw something on LinkedIn which really got my back up, actually, as opportunistic in a bit, you know, parasitic in a way. And I saw a company offering coronavirus or COVID-19 courses on basically how to wash your hands for $30 a piece. And it really struck me as, I don't know, you can call it opportunistic or capitalist in a sense, but what the world didn't really need was someone to come out with a course, a management course on how to effectively wash your hands and keep yourself safe and self-isolate for a princely sum of $30 per head or per individual. And I didn't actually click into the course, but I do wonder whether they would actually attend on site and give a presentation in front of hundreds of people, or whether it was going to be run virtually.
Oh, that would be saying there's so much hypocrisy, so much irony in the space.
And continuing this one, actually, you picked up on another corona-based set of shenanigans. Do you want to elaborate?
Yeah, this is beautiful.
On the Corona coin.
Yes. I'm so glad you mentioned the blockchain. Right, the blockchain's going to save everything. Well, there's a capitalist for every opportunity and for every threat. That's what we really need to know. But anyway, the set of crypto coin developers, developed a coin that they call Corona coin, where you can buy it and basically bet on how many people globally, worldwide, are going to die from the virus. So the coin supply is tied to the number of people in the world. And for every verified corona-related death, the value of the coin token changes. The good news is I see their website was suspended this morning. So someone's obviously said it's totally not cool to bet on death when we're having a literal plague in the world. But the point is that people actually bought the stuff and someone else built it, which is really depressing for the future of humanity. So when you start talking about things like that, people selling Corona courses and Corona coins, it really comes back to how we opened this conversation with, like, do you really want to live forever on this third rock from the sun with these people?
Yeah. And I take it this is one coin which people will not be holding on for dear life, or HODL, as I keep seeing everywhere. I've seen that Bitcoin is tanking as well.
Yeah.
I think it's below $6,000 at the moment. it seems every market is falling by the wayside under this under the weight of the coronavirus. Well, that's pretty much what we have for Get in the Sea episode one. Bronwyn, have you got anything that you would like to end the show with on a positive note?
Oh, on a positive note, well, the positive note is that, all these things we've spoken about, is they're still hypothetical threats. And if we are smart people, we can always change these trajectories if it's not going the way that we want it to go. So I think that that's the encouraging side of it. And there are people that are doing things like trying to hold Bitcoin and all the rest of it, which shows that there are some people trying to resist the sort of inevitability of a lot of the surveillance tech that we've spoken about today. And I think that's the encouraging point. The other encouraging point is, of course, the whole corona thing, as much as it is a completely terrible time, both in terms of health and in terms of economics worldwide, there's definitely been a positive side that I've seen come out of that in the fact that there's been a global solidarity around this. So as much as global geopolitics might be nationalizing at the moment with the trade wars going on all around the world and closing of borders and trade and all of that, I think that humans themselves have remembered that we are all sort of flesh and blood people stuck on the same rock hurtling through space to an uncertain future. And if we can learn to at least get along a bit more and to remember that we are these warm-blooded creatures and we only really have each other to cling on to as we go face our fate, maybe there is some positivity that could come out of this in terms of a more human solidarity going forward.
Bronwyn, thank you very much for joining me on this first episode of Get in the Sea. Where can we find out more about you?
Well, you can go to my website, that's whatthefuturenow.com. Otherwise, you can find me at Flux Trends, where I'm a trend analyst and foresight lead there, or I'm pretty much always on Twitter, at Bronwyn Williams.
Well, that's it for the first episode of Get in the Sea. We will be recording more of these and consigning more things, useless objects, to the bottom of the Marianas Trench over the next coming weeks. You will find this podcast on Spotify, Google Podcasts, and hopefully iTunes once they pull their finger out. Spread the word, please. Subscribe, and we'll see you next time. Thank you very much.
Thank you.